Ladies and gentlemen, David Eagleman.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here. And just as a point of clarification, my 12th birthday is next week, so. Okay, well, I'm really happy to be here and tell you guys about my favorite topic, which is the intersection of neuroscience and the legal system. I've never had it introduced before by the moon illusion, but I think it's a nice idea. One way that you can prove the moon illusion to yourself is just holding up your thumb and comparing the size of the moon at the horizon and then when it's at the top, and you'll see it's the same size. And I think the goal today is to see how we can hold out our thumb and look at the legal system and find out what the problems are there that maybe we've been overlooking. So this is your brain. It's about 3 pounds. It's the most complicated device that we've ever found in the universe. It's made up of about 10 billion cells. That's just in the cortex, just the outer part of your brain. And those cells are about as complicated as a city. Each one of those cells has the entire human genome. It's trafficking millions of proteins. And each one of these cells makes connections to about 10,000 other neurons. So in total, what you have are trillions of connections in the brain. And that means that if you were to take a cubic millimeter of brain tissue, you have as many connections in there as you have stars in the Milky Way galaxy. So it's a very complicated system, and this is what I and thousands of others have devoted our lives to trying to figure out. Since this is going to be a short talk, I'm going to summarize everything we know in modern neuroscience with 4 words, which is, you are your brain. And this is something of a, it's a little bit of a generalization, but I'm going to try to argue why we think this is the case. And essentially, it's because imagine you were to lose your pinky in an accident. Well, you would be sad about that, but you wouldn't be any different as a person. If you lose an equivalently sized chunk of brain tissue, that changes you completely. It changes your capacity for decision making, your capacity to speak language, your ability to see colors or name animals. So we know that the brain is the densest representation of you in the body. Now, I'm going to try to give you a few examples to convince you of this point. How many people here know who Phineas Gage was? Okay, about a quarter of the people. For those who don't, he was a young railroad worker about 120 years ago in Virginia, and his job on the railroad was to use a metal tamping rod. He would put gunpowder in these little holes and sand on top of that and then tamp it down, and they would use these to make explosions to build the railroad. But one day he accidentally caused a spark when he hit the tamping rod down, and there was an explosion, and the tamping rod blew through his head with such force that it clattered to the ground 40 meters away. And the reason Phineas Gage became a famous medical case is because he didn't die. And in fact, he didn't even lose consciousness. But what did happen with Phineas Gage is he became a completely different person. So people who knew him said, he's no longer Phineas Gage. He's somebody else now. And in fact, he went from being a nice guy and a responsible citizen to he took to cussing and gambling and sleeping with prostitutes and just became a totally different person that was unrecognizable. So in the intervening 120 years, we have seen many more of these natural experiments like this that all drive home this point that when your biology changes, you change. You depend on the integrity of your biology for your capacity for decision making. How many people know who this is? Remember Charles Whitman. So for those of you who don't remember, in 1966, Charles Whitman climbed to the top of the tower at the University of Texas at Austin, and he brought with him guns and food and knives, and he started shooting at people indiscriminately from the top of the tower. And in total, he killed 14 people and injured 33. And it was completely random shooting. He was shooting at the pedestrians. He shot at the ambulance drivers that came to help the pedestrians. Finally, 4 deputies made it to the top of the tower and were able to kill him. Now, it turns out the thing that was so shocking about this was that there was nothing about Charles Whitman that would have presaged this sort of act. He had been honorably discharged from the military. He had been an Eagle Scout. He worked as a bank teller. He had a high IQ. He was married. So the question was, what happened here exactly? And it turns out that upon further investigation, they in looking at this, they went to his home and found that the night before he had murdered his wife and his mother in their beds. And he had written out a suicide note. And in this long suicide note, he said, you know, I feel like something inside me has been changing over the last year, and I've been the victim of irrational thoughts. And it turns out he'd gone to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist wasn't able to offer any help. And he said, I feel like something's changing, and when this is all over, I want there to be an autopsy performed. So that's exactly what happened. They performed an autopsy, and does anyone know what they found? They found he had a brain tumor. He had a brain tumor that had been growing over the past year, and it was impinging on a part of his brain called the amygdala, which is the area involved in fear and aggression. And so at that time, there was no easy way to do a diagnosis of something like that. And so he, from a medical point of view, really slipped right under the radar. And then the consequences were clear. I'll give you another example from the recent literature. This was a man who was 40 years old, had a normal sexual appetite. He started to become a pedophile. Took an increasing interest in child pornography, in children. His wife, who had known him for 20 years, knew that there was something really different about this. It wasn't his normal style. It wasn't his normal sexual appetite. So she took him to the neurologist to see if something was going on. They did a scan. They found out he had a massive frontal tumor. So this white part here is the tumor. So what happened is the surgeons resected the tumor, and his sexual behavior returned exactly to normal. About 6 months later, he started showing an interest in pedophilia again. So his wife took him back. It turns out the surgeons had missed a spot, and the tumor was regrowing. So they did a second operation, resected the rest of it, and his behavior went back to normal. So what we can see is that you are your brain, and when your biology changes, you change as well. And of course, everybody intuitively knows this, and so people self-administer invisibly small molecules all the time, right? So people are taking in alcohol, pouring it over their mucosal membranes to make themselves funnier at a party, and so on. Drugs of all sorts are administered. Who knows who this is? This is Chris Benoit, who is a professional wrestler who was on massive doses of steroids and went into a roid rage and came home and killed his wife and son and then hung himself from one of his weight cable pulleys because he was on a roid rage. And I'm even including prescription medications in here. How many of you guys know what's happening with Parkinson's medications? Okay, a few of you. Yeah, well, what's happening is these Parkinson's medications are getting prescribed, and then the people who are on them are going off to Las Vegas and blowing their family's fortune on gambling. And the reason is those Parkinson's medications affect part of a neurotransmitter system called dopamine, and dopamine is not only involved in being able to move, but it happens to also be the same neurotransmitter in a different part of the brain that's involved in the reward system and in risk aversion or appetite for risk. And it turns out that when you modulate the dopamine system, you completely change people's appetite for gambling. And so now this is listed as one of the warnings of the medication, is that it leads to compulsive gambling. So what we can see is that as you change even little chemicals in the brain, that changes the kind of decisions you make, changes who you are. So nowadays, when we're talking about morality and decision making, really what we're talking about is the neural basis of this. This all leads to a very deep question that's been floating around for millennia, which is this issue of free will. Do we actually have the capacity to navigate our own decisions? Is the mind separate from the brain, or is it really the same thing? And all the evidence that we have from brain damage, narcotics, disease states, and so on, suggests that these are probably not separate, the mind and the brain, but instead the mind is what the brain does. And what's really clear is that almost everything you think and do and act and believe is driven by parts of your brain that you have no access to, and you're not even very well acquainted with. And the conscious you, the part you think of as, you know, as I, is the smallest bit of what's happening in the brain. Just about everything that's going on in terms of your instincts and drives, what you find attractive, what you find repulsive, what you find interesting, all that stuff has nothing to do with you. That's all the subterranean machinery that's cranking along. And that's the stuff that can get changed very easily by disease states or chemicals or things like that. And so it turns out that the free will question about, do we have any free will at all, or is it all mechanical? It turns out that's a difficult question to answer, and philosophers have been arguing that for years, and scientists as well. We don't have killer evidence one way or the other, so it remains an open question. But in my next book, I'm making a very specific suggestion about how the legal system can deal with this important question, which is, there's already something in the legal system called an automatism, which is, if I have a disorder where, let's say, I have spasms of my arms, something called hemibolismus, if I hit somebody off of a cliff, I'm not culpable for that because it wasn't really me, right? It was just an automatism, as the legal system calls it. What I'm proposing in my next book is the law of sufficient automatism, which is to say, enough of what drives us, enough of who we are, the kinds of decisions we make, enough of that is inaccessible to us that free will, if it exists at all, is really a bit player in what's happening in terms of people's lives and decisions. So what this leads to is the very deep question, the question at the core of the legal system, which is, what does all this mean for the notion of culpability? How do we think about responsibility now, given what we know in neuroscience and what we know about human behavior in general? Well, the problem is there's a big disconnect between science and the way the legal system is structured. The legal system essentially rests on two assumptions. The first is that we are all practical reasoners, which is a way of saying that we are free to choose how we act. And the second assumption is that all brains can be treated equally, which sounds very nice, but in fact it's totally erroneous thinking, because along any spectrum that you measure brains, you find a large spectrum, whether that's intelligence or aggression or empathy or skill at chess or anything you're measuring, you find a real spectrum with brains. And so the system essentially rests on this reasonable man standard, which is, well, okay, what would any reasonable man have done in this situation? Well, the problem is there may not be a reasonable man. There might not be any such person out there because brains are on this really large spectrum, and it's not clear that we're the ones driving the boat anyway. So the situation we find ourselves in 2010 is that these probably aren't good assumptions upon which to predicate a legal system, and modern neuroscience, I'm going to suggest, indicates some more fruitful ways that we can take things. So the first thing I want to emphasize here is that when we're looking for biological understanding, we're not talking about exculpating criminals. If there's an explanation for what's going on, it doesn't mean people get off the hook. We still are going to be taking people off the streets and putting them in prisons, because that's what the system is for, is to clean up the streets and have a system where the rest of the society can thrive. And if somebody is overly aggressive and under-empathetic and is going out and hurting other people, then we're going to remove them from the streets. So it's not that explanation leads to exculpation. What a biological understanding allows us, finally, is to do rational sentencing, customized rehabilitation, and structuring the incentives for the population properly. That's what we get out of a biological understanding. So I'll try to illustrate some of these points through the talk. Okay, so what I want to do by way of sort of setting this up is I've already told you that you are your brain, but the reason I mentioned to you at the beginning about the complexity of the system is, it's not the case that we have an understanding of it. It's not the case that we have a real detailed understanding. We know the first statement is sort of true, and we know that the second statement is true also. So how are we actually going about studying it, and how well do we understand it currently, and what does that mean for us? I'm going to spend a few slides talking about this. So most of you probably know that with modern-day neuroimaging, we can look non-invasively inside the brain, and this is a tremendous technology because it allows us, for the first time, to see how people are making decisions, what they're thinking about, things like that, on the fly, non-invasively, and peer inside of the skull. So things like magnetic resonance imaging and functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, these are technologies that are on the cutting edge and that we're using every day. But the thing I want to emphasize is that it's actually, even though it's our best technology, it's actually quite crude. It's very limited. We are not able to tell a lot of what's going on. So take this as an analogy. Let's say you were an astronaut in the space shuttle, and you were looking down over the state of Louisiana, and you were asked to describe something about what was going on here. Well, you would be able to tell if there was a big flood going on, or you'd be able to tell if there was a forest fire somewhere, But that's about it. If you were asked to judge something about the state of the local economy or how happy people were, you wouldn't be able to tell that from that distance. You're simply too far, right? Well, that's our situation with our best technologies right now. We can see the forest fires. We can see when there's a big flood happening, but we can't see much more than that. And that's a very important point because it puts undue pressure on neuroscientists and clinicians to say more than they're able in courts of law. When a criminal is brought in and the judge or the jury wants to see if there's a brain scan and what that means about the person's behavior, the fact is we're able to see big problems but not small problems, not problems at the level of the microcircuitry. So what does that mean for us? Well, it means... So here's a typical cover of Time magazine that says, here's what makes us good and evil, and there's a little spot that points to Gandhi and one to Hitler. And this is classic Time magazine erroneous thinking. And unfortunately, it feeds a popular misconception that we do know more than we do, and that it would even boil down to something like spots in your brain that tell you whether you're good or evil, as though those binary categories even make sense. The problem is we find ourselves a lot of times in situations where we don't quite know what to do about it. So who knows who Patricia Reggiani is? She was the wife of Maurizio Gucci, the Gucci fashion fortune heir, and she had him killed with a hitman. And so she went to Italian court, was found guilty. She was locked away. Upon appeal, she came back to the Italian court and she said, you know what? Turns out I've got a little small frontal brain tumor, and we just discovered this, and it was probably growing at the time that I did the hit, and so I want a retrial. Well, of course, she had been publicly saying for years how much she hated her husband, so people were a little skeptical. But the thing is, this went to court, and nobody exactly knew what to do with it. I mean, what if she really did have that brain tumor at the time? Is that a biological mitigator, or should it not be? And then the problem is with a lot of many crimes, like this was the Virginia Tech shooter, we don't have any brain data at all. We don't have any evidence about his brain because like most school shooters, he was killed at the scene and there's no evidence about what was going on in his brain. So what this means is, despite all the knowledge we've accumulated in neuroscience, there's lots of situations where we're not exactly sure what to do with somebody. So coming back to this main question of what this means for culpability, one of my colleagues in Europe has recently made a suggestion that's interesting and controversial. I thought I'd mention it here. He said, look, maybe the act of committing a crime is all the evidence you need for a brain abnormality. And abnormality here just means statistically abnormality. It's not a value judgment on it. But it's saying, since most people don't go and shoot up their classmates at school, even though lots of kids are bullied and have social problems, even if we can't measure Cho's brain, we can assume that there's something different about his brain than a normal one, because normal kids don't go off and do that. So this is the viewpoint. I'll just spend a minute looking at this a little bit, because this just came up a couple of months ago. Who recognizes this person? This is Dr. Amy Bishop, a geneticist who 2 months ago shot her colleagues at a faculty meeting at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. So her lawyer, I think, adopted Dr. Singer's point of view on it by saying to the media the next day, this is what her defense attorney said, I just think the case speaks for itself. I think she's wacko. This is her defense attorney. And then the next day, when the media came back to ask him about that, to really pressure him on it, here's what he said. He said, good Lord, y'all. Listen, I went overboard with that. When I talk to y'all, I make statements I wish I hadn't have made. And probably that's one of them. What was interesting to me was his next statement when he said, doctors of biology have got, in my estimation, high IQs. And the high IQ, in my opinion, is sometimes not good for people. Okay. That's a tangent. But what I wanna lead to the point is this. The point is, what we have in modern neuroscience and the legal system is essentially a spectrum where we have a clear ability to measure some things and not others. So on the one hand, we say to Phineas Gage, oh, you poor guy, you had a tamping rod through your head. That's a biological mitigator. That's not your fault, right? And then with Chris Benoit, we say, well, geez, we understand you were on these massive doses of testosterone. You were on a roid rage. It's, you know, you weren't really yourself. Drug addiction in general is somewhere sort of in the middle. We know very well that drugs rewire the circuitry of the brain. But there's still some sense of well, maybe it's your fault a little bit because you're the one who started doing it. And then with someone like Amy Bishop, we don't know what's wrong with her yet. I mean, there'll be studies, but we're not sure. And all the way at the other end of the spectrum, we've got, let's say, the common criminal, where there's nothing obvious going on. It's not like he's got a brain tumor. So the situation this puts us in is we have a line drawn by technology. And the way it currently works is if you're on this side of the line, we say, oh, you poor guy, it's not really your fault. And if you're on that side of the line, we say, you know what, we're going to hurt you. We're gonna punish you because that's your fault. The problem is it does not make any sense to predicate a legal system on our current line of technology, because as technology develops, it will continue to drift to the left as we develop fMRI into xMRI, and the next thing, 20, 30 years from now, we will develop better and better understandings of what's going on at the level of the microcircuitry. We'll be able to have better biological understanding of why people do what they do, and it cannot be a just system to say in one decade you are guilty and you are culpable of this, and then in the next decade say, oh, well, we have a better biological understanding, and so we're not going to punish you now. So the issue is that maybe culpability is not the right question for us to be asking. Maybe it does not make sense for us to say, okay, was it your fault or was it your brain's fault? Because it's the same thing. That's what we're learning, is that it doesn't make any sense to separate those out as though they're separate questions and then base our punishment on whether you have that biological mitigator or not. So what I'm going to suggest is that the legal system needs a revision, and the right way to have it, there's only one right way, and that is to ask what to do moving forward. We need a completely forward-looking legal system where you say, look, given the brain that's in front of the judge's bench right now, what do we do with it? We don't want to spend our time saying, well, to what extent are you blameworthy versus a brain tumor versus something about in utero alcohol poisoning or bad genes or bad childhood environment or sexual abuse as a child. Forget it. We can't ever untangle that. It's way too complicated a system. What we need to be asking is, what do we do from here? So I'm going to give you some examples of what a forward-looking legal system looks like. And as I said, explanation does not lead to exculpation. It leads to these things. So I'll give you some examples. One of them is with rational sentencing. As we develop a better biological understanding, we can stop using incarceration as the blunt tool that we currently do, where in many places, judges have mandates where they have to put people in prison for set amounts of time. And we can have a much more refined system as we understand issues about people's behavior. We can start to base sentencing on the probability of reoffense. So if somebody is a really bad seed and is going to keep reoffending, then we put them away for a very long time. And if somebody was in some crazy circumstance and they are very unlikely to keep reoffending, we put them away for a shorter time. I should mention, we already have this built into the legal system in a few places. For example, a crime of passion where a wife kills her husband who was cheating on her, that's already seen as an unlikely situation that she's going to recidivate a lot, and they tend to get shorter sentences. So that's already built in a little bit in the system, but not very much. And I'm going to give you one example where it has been successful and show how maybe we can expand that. And my general dream here is that we should be able to run social policy exactly as rigorously as we run a science experiment. There's no reason why it should be based on people's intuitions about who's going to recidivate and who's not and what recidivism rates this is measurable stuff, and I'll show you an example of ways that this has been measured. And I think what you'll find is that it probably doesn't match your intuition very well. So I'm going to start, just to loosen up our intuitions here, I'm going to start by showing you some rearrest rates for different kinds of crimes. Can people in the back see these numbers? Shoot, okay. So what we're looking at is robbers, burglars, larcenists, motor vehicle thieves, stolen property, and illegal weapons, and it's the rearrest rate is on the y-axis, and we're asking in a 3-year follow-up study, how many people reoffend. And what you find are the numbers are very high. This is the interactive part. What do you guys think is the rearrest rate for driving under the influence of alcohol? What do you suppose it is? Throw out a number. Okay, it's 50 actually. Yep. Okay. Here's another question. What about sex offenders? What do you think the reoffense rate is for sex offenders? Okay, I'm hearing everything from 20 to 100. Yeah, boy, that's exactly right. Sex offense is far too broad a category. And in fact, we can talk about that because that's one of my favorite topics. But for the purposes, no, I mean it's a really. It's very important for us to distinguish those the subdomains of that. Because okay, but what I want to talk about is for all categories of sex offense, what is the recidivism rate? So okay, so I've heard from 20 to 100. In fact, it's 8%. And there have been follow-up studies done in dozens of states for not just 3-year, but up to 15-year follow-up studies and across all states. And this is all that categories lumped together. It's very low. So this is something that surprises the intuition. Why? Because politicians always say sex offenders have a high recidivism rate. It's totally false. It's just completely counter to the data. The thing is, it's very easy for a politician to say, I'm hard on sex offenders. And it's very difficult for a politician to say, well, look, let's reassess this. Just to give you another sense of building our intuition on this stuff, there have been several studies now that follow out sex offenders for many years and ask all sorts of questions about them, and then try to figure out what factors correlate with recidivism. What are the important factors that determine whether somebody reoffends or not? And so in total, there have been over 23,000 sex offenders followed out and tracked for recidivism. And my question to you is, which ones do you think are the important factors in that correlate with if somebody reoffends? How about being sexually abused as a child? Okay, some of sexual deviance. How about things like antisocial personality disorder, which is essentially the same as psychopathy? What do you think? Correlates? Yeah. How about things like low remorse or denial? Okay. Okay, well, here are the actual numbers from over 23,000 people. Being sexually abused as a child has no relationship to whether you recidivate. There's no relationship at all. The highest predictors are sexual deviance, meaning you like, for example, children instead of adults, you know, something that's unusual. Prior offenses is a biggie. Deviant victim choice, so you find a boy that's outside of the family, let's say, and sexual interest in children. These are strong predictors. Turns out that things like antisocial personality disorder, the number of prior offenses, the failure to complete treatment, or the negative relationship with the mother, not so predictive. And things like low remorse and denial and distress have no predictive value at all. They don't. Okay, so what's the importance of studies like this? Well, we're bringing science to the table to address these things. There's a lot of power in the numbers because it turns out that when you ask psychiatrists and parole boards, do you think this person is going to reoffend? You might as well be throwing darts at a dartboard. They have almost no correlation, a 0.1 correlation, with what actually happens. What this means is that one's intuitions are very poor. And instead, there's real power in the numbers. And so people have taken the study that I just showed you with the different factors, the statistical factors, and turned these into essentially actuarial tables, where you say, okay, well, given that you are a prior offender and you have this sexual deviance and you this, that, da-da, you look through all the factors, you look it up in a table and you say, okay, this person is really a bad seed. This person has a very high probability of reoffense. We're going to make a longer sentence. This person, on the other hand, has a very low probability of recidivism given the 23,000 people that have come before him. And of course, we improve the models on the fly with each new offender. And so this person can have a shorter sentence. So this is already in use in courtrooms. This is already going on now where people are taking the science and using that to navigate social policy. And I think that's really the right direction. And one of the things I'm doing in my lab is asking whether these predictions can be improved by neuroscience. So instead of just looking at the behavioral tests, we're actually doing brain imaging with sex offenders and asking these questions about what things correlate with recidivism. We're just adding to the data that's already there in terms of, by adding to it, neurobiological data. Now, of course, I want to make very clear the notes of caution here, which is that one can never have 100% correlation. You're never going to know how somebody's going to behave for many reasons. Mostly it's because life is too complicated and you are a product of your context and your environment as much as anything else. It will never be the case that we will punish for tendencies instead of action. It's a tenet of American jurisprudence that you cannot punish somebody before they have committed a crime. So that's not where this is leading. And as I mentioned, the behavior depends on the context. So we can look for important lessons from genetics here, because genetics have had to deal with this for a long time, which is to say there are predispositions to certain sorts of behaviors, and you can actually improve the data and find out how to use sentencing as a tool that's rational without going overboard and pretending that that correlation will ever be 100%. Now, the thing I want to emphasize on top of that is that when we're talking about rational sentencing, it doesn't just have to be the modulation of jail terms. So I want to talk about customized rehabilitation. There hasn't been a new suggestion for rehab from the neuroscience community since the prefrontal lobotomy, which turned out to be a pretty bad idea. So why not? Well, it turns out we've got terrific technologies now, and so one of the things my lab is doing is really working on a new method for rehabilitation, and if it works, it's going to really be a game changer. So I'd like to explain that to you. The general thing is that, you know, with incarceration, we as a nation essentially are using that as a one-size-fits-all solution. You guys probably know that America has the highest proportion of its citizens in jail of any country in the world. Our incarceration rate has quadrupled in the last 20 years. So there are better ideas out there, and I think neuroscience can contribute new methods to this. So in order for me to explain to you how this works, I have to take one step back and explain something about how we think about the mind now in neuroscience. So law, the legal system, thinks about the mind as being a single entity. So you've got the mind, and that's what controls your behavior. So for example, in one of the tests of guilt, you know, you have to make sure that nothing is interfering with the ability of the mind to control the way in which the body is moving. And I'm arguing in my next book that this is really the wrong way to think about the mind. Why? Because in fact, you don't just have a single mind, you have a whole population going on in there. The right way to think about the mind and the brain is more like a representative democracy. You have a whole bunch of competing subsystems in your brain that are all trying to drive the single output channel of your behavior. And this is why you can get mad at yourself and cuss at yourself and make agreements with yourself. I mean, who's cussing at who when you're mad at yourself, right? There are a bunch of yous going on in there. As Whitman said, I am large, I contain multitudes. So, if I put that chocolate in front of you, part of you wants to eat it, and part of you says, no, don't, you'll get fat. And so part of you says, okay, I'll make a deal, you go to the gym tomorrow. And whatever, you're negotiating with yourself on all kinds of different timescales. This is the right way to think about the brain. So what we're doing is leveraging this and using a very bleeding-edge technology to try to accomplish something very useful here. What we're doing is using something called real-time feedback with functional magnetic resonance imaging. This is a brain imaging technology. And this is very new. We've just developed the computational capacity to be able to scan your brain and on the fly look at the activity in your brain and show that to you visually with, let's say, a bar on the screen. And you can, using the same old ideas from biofeedback from the 70s, you can actually start controlling the activity in your brain that way. So let me explain what the idea is here. The easiest way to explain this is we're starting with cigarette smokers. And what we're doing is we put a cigarette smoker in the scanner, and we show them smoking cues. This activates the networks in their brain that are involved in craving. They want those cigarettes. What we do is we image that on the fly, we figure out what those networks are, and we represent the activity in those networks by a bar on the screen, and the smoker's job is to make that bar go down. They surf through their mental space, and they figure out whatever they need to make that bar go down. They may or may not have conscious access to what they're doing to make that happen, but the idea is they are learning to use other parts of their brain, the parts of their brain that care about long-term decision-making, to squelch their impulses, to squelch the craving that they have going on. And the idea is if they practice this over and over and over, what they're doing is they're strengthening the circuits that are essentially in their frontal lobe, their prefrontal cortex. They're strengthening those circuits that allow them to implement impulse control. And the idea is with these competing populations in the brain, some care about short-term gratification, some care about long-term decision-making, and what we're doing is we're pitting those against each other and teaching the smoker here how to tip that balance. Now, we've just begun these studies, and so it'll be 6 months or a year before we know if this works well. If it does, I'm taking it straight to the criminal population. Because the thing that characterizes most criminals is that they have very poor impulse control. If you catch them in a moment of sober reflection, they can tell you very well what the right and wrong thing to do is, but they have poor impulse control. They're not well socialized. They're not able to control their own decisions. So I call this the prefrontal gym, and the idea is it works for people who want to change. It works for people who want to strengthen up their ability to control their own impulses. And to my mind, what I've always liked about this idea, to my mind, it has nice libertarian appeal because I'm very uncomfortable with the idea of a government being able to muck with your brain at any point. But this works for people who want to change themselves, who want to try to improve their long-term decision making. And so this is just one idea of where we're moving forward, trying to introduce new ideas of rehabilitation. There will be, you know, there will be some places where neuroscience can say to the legal system, look, you know, here's what you need to think about in terms of human behavior and so on. But there will be other places where we can say, you know what, we've got a new technology for you. We're not just going to talk about free will and so on. We're going to actually give you tools to work with for rehabilitation that might offer a less crude tool than throwing everybody into prison. Since I'm just doing a short talk here, I'm just going to surf over the top of several other points where neuroscience and law interact with one another. So one of them, of course, is with lie detection. So there have been two companies started in California that are using fMRI, brain imaging technology, to ask the question of can we make improvements on the polygraph test? There's another company that looks at thermal measures. It turns out that under the orbit of your eyes, you get hotter when you're making a lie. There are EEG, electroencephalography measures that people are using. All these are, again, in an effort to try to improve detection of lies from what we've had with the polygraph test, which is actually already pretty good. It's at least 80% accuracy with that. There are, of course, problems with this, which is we have a poor understanding of what a lie is. Lie detectors aren't detecting lies. They're detecting the attendant emotional stress response that comes along with a lie. And so so those issues haven't gone away. And, of course, there's always the issue that somebody could be telling the truth, but they're factually incorrect. So the same issues that lived with the polygraph test are still there. Nonetheless, people are working on ways of improving this. So this is a contact point between neuroscience and the legal system. Everybody, I'm sure, at this point is very familiar with the problems of eyewitness testimony. Memory is not like a video recorder. Memory is reconstructed. And yet, despite whatever you do to try to educate juries on this sort of thing, you can show them videos on this, you can prove this to them 100 ways from Sunday, and they still say, okay, that might be true, but I know I have a good memory. So people, it's very difficult to convince people that their memories are not like a video recorder. So, and in fact, just as a footnote, some people have been worried about the effect that fMRI pictures will have in the courtroom because, you know, it's a visually compelling picture. And so some of my colleagues have been worried that maybe juries will be overly swayed by a scientist coming in and saying, hey, look, we have a picture of the brain here. So I had one of my students run a quick study where we compared the influence that has to a pretty eyewitness who gets up and says, well, I don't know about all that brain stuff, but I know what I saw, and that has much more influence on people than any brain pictures, right? So this is a real problem, and neuroscience has contributed a lot over the years in continuing to try to show that memory is a construction. I just recently wrote a paper called Why Neuroscience Matters for a Rational Drug Policy. So as you know, we have wasted so much money in the war on drugs by attacking the supply of drugs, and it's like a water balloon where you press down in one place and it comes up elsewhere. The only way to solve the problem of addiction and all the attendant ills of addiction is to concentrate on the demand, not on the supply. And what we're able to do in neuroscience is understand the brain of addiction and address that. So we know a good deal now about how the circuitry gets rewired by the drugs of addiction, what the neurotransmitter systems are that are involved, how they get hijacked by these drugs. And so what we're doing in neuroscience is coming up with good ways to actually address the problem. So there's a lot of work on the circuitry and the pharmacology of ways to address this and get people off of drug addiction. We're going to be using this thing I showed you a moment ago about real-time feedback and fMRI to try to increase people's impulse control in deference to long-term decision-making. And one of my colleagues at Baylor College of Medicine is developing something very interesting. There are all sorts of legal and ethical discussions to be had here, but he's developing a cocaine vaccine where essentially you inject somebody, it raises an immune response, so then when they snort cocaine, it gets sopped up by their immune system before it gets to their brain, and they're unable to get a high. Now, there are all sorts of interesting questions about that, but it's just one more example of several ways that neuroscience can actually try to take a rational approach to drug addiction instead of the hundreds of billions of dollars spent on the war on drugs. There are several other things that fall in this area, this nexus between neuroscience and law. There's a lot of interesting stuff about competency and capacity to act. When can you sign a contract if you're demented, let's say? Patient signing medical consents. One of my colleagues has been asking this question recently about what happened with the subprime mortgage meltdown. You know, those are very complicated contracts, and there's an interesting question about when is somebody unable to understand the contract because they don't have a high enough IQ to sign something like that. There's all sorts of open questions here, but this is a contact point. I'm not going to talk too much about these points, but brain death, you know, we now understand that death is a process. It's not an event. Parts of you can die without other parts. And for many decades now, the legal and the medical communities have been having a dialogue about where you draw the line for brain death and say that somebody's dead. And there's a lot of exciting work happening here now where we can take somebody in a persistent vegetative state and put them in a brain scanner and ask them questions. And by looking at what their brain activity responses are, we can essentially finally answer the question of, is there somebody in there or not? So this is a very exciting area of progress. And then, of course, there are going to be all sorts of issues in the near-term future when people really nail some good nootropics, which are smart drugs. So we already use all kinds of, you know, mediocre nootropics like caffeine or cigarettes or things like that to make ourselves more alert. But as we come to have a better understanding of learning and memory, there is going to be the development of drugs that kids will pay any amount of money for when they're taking the MCATs or the LSATs. And the same kind of problems we have with anabolic steroids in the Olympics, we're going to have with all these smart rich kids when we have really good smart drugs. So this is an area to keep your eye on for the future. The last thing that I want to mention is I'm doing a lot of work right now with the other half of the equation when we're looking at the legal system, which is what's going on with the jurors' brains, right? Because it turns out that I mentioned before that I believe that the right way to structure the legal system is in a utilitarian way where you predicate sentencing on the probability of recidivism. The problem is there's a lot of retributivism out there. There's this retributive impulse where people want blood, right? There's a lot of bloodlust. This is very naturally wired into us. How many people have heard the term altruistic punishment? You guys know what that means? It means that you are willing to give up your own resources to see a cheater punished because we hate cheaters so much. We hate norm violators so much. We are very hardwired for this, and presumably this has been something that has helped us through the millions of years as we've developed. I mean, you see this all through the animal kingdom, actually. When there's a cheater, the rest of the pack will punish him. So we're very hardwired for that. And there's now a lot of good study on this about how it feels good to hurt norm violators. So in fact, if you play, let's say, an economic exchange game with somebody and you're in the scanner and they do something where they sort of cheat you out of money that they should be giving you back, and if you have the capacity to hit a button to punish them, to either take away money from them or give them an electric shock, it feels good. It activates the reward systems in the brain. It activates the same areas that are activated when people reward cooperators. The punishment of a defector will activate these same areas. So in other words, instead of feeling bad about having been cheated, you feel really good about exacting revenge. And this is so hardwired in us. This is a part of all of our stories. So here's a picture of Dirty Harry informing a norm violator that he anticipates deriving satisfaction from inflicting altruistic punishment. Right? And we love this sort of thing. So this is an open, you know, this is something that we have to figure out. If we want to move the legal system towards a utilitarian system, we have to deal with the fact that jurors have bloodlust. And as a community, when you study this, by the way, what you find is that there's a real spectrum. Some people are very retributive. They have this very strong impulse, and other people are on the other end of the spectrum, and they are more forgiving. And it turns out this thing that I showed you before with the reward centers, that's more true for men than for women. Men will, the more, they also ask with a questionnaire about how much you want to punish that person, and that correlates with how strongly those reward systems activate. Men have this really strong desire to punish and strong activation reward systems, and for women it's less in general. Okay, so as we are interested in reforming the system, we need to understand what's going on with that other half of the equation. So what I'm doing in my laboratory is doing a lot of testing on how jurors make decisions, what kind of evidence they're swayed by. It turns out people are much more swayed if there's physical interaction involved, if there's something that involves, you know, blood and guts kind of stuff, than if it's something that happened at a distance, let's say poisoning or something along those lines, and that has to do with the areas of the brain that get activated. If this area called the limbic system gets activated by the sort of grossness of it, people have very different responses in terms of what they think should be done. We're looking at how people view biological mitigators, like, okay, X did the crime but was schizophrenic, or X did the crime but had epilepsy, X did the crime but was on drugs. We look at how those biological mitigators influence people based on how much they know about schizophrenia or epilepsy or drug addiction. And not surprisingly, if anyone has, you know, if there's somebody here who has a schizophrenic sibling or a cousin or something like that, and you know more about it, then you view it very differently. When there's an insanity defense and somebody is somebody pleads the insanity defense, it's viewed very differently than if you don't really understand anything about schizophrenia and you call bullshit on it. And you say, "I don't believe that at all. He's just like me, and he made a bad free will choice because I wouldn't have made that choice, and he did. So he should be punished for it." So what we're doing is understanding this both at the level of what kinds of evidence influences people, and then we're using neuroimaging to see what's going on in people's brains. There's also a new technology that we've developed at Baylor College of Medicine called hyperscanning. And this is where you can have multiple people in multiple scanners at the same time interacting with each other over video screens, and we're measuring all of their brains at the same time. And with this, what I'm doing now is setting up mock juries and seeing how people influence each other in terms of this sort of decision making. So you can essentially put people in and analyze it like a mega brain. So this is the sort of thing that we're doing right now. So I'm going to summarize this so that we have enough time for questions. Theoretically speaking, what my dream is to make this sort of social policy as rigorous as a science experiment so that we can have an evidence-based legal system instead of one based on people's intuitions, whether that's intuitions about, oh, I think sex offenders reoffend all the time, or I think these are the important factors in what makes a reoffender, or things like that. It just doesn't make sense to have a legal system that way because we've got the numbers and we have the capacity to make the measurements. And I mentioned several examples about the domain of neuro law, where neuroscience and legal system interact. And some examples of those was I was showing you neuroimaging of sex offenders for the improvement of recidivism assessment, real-time feedback in fMRI for rehabilitation, this idea of the prefrontal gym, and jury decision-making, really understanding how people make those sorts of decisions. And I just want to close by saying one of the things that Whitman put in his suicide note, he said, if my life insurance policy is valid, please pay off my debts and donate the rest to a mental health foundation. Maybe research can prevent further tragedies of this type. He was very high IQ and had a lot of insight into what was going on with him. So that's all I'm going to say, and I'd like to take questions from you guys now. Thanks very much.